I'm bothered about you being behind me. That makes me very
dangerous.
But what bothers me more is Matt Basker is watching me in the overflow. So they're supposed to text me when he laughs at me.
Say something funny first.
Huh? That was I'm laughing on the inside. That was on the inside. That was really funny. Not enough to make it out there. Let's pray again. It's a blessing, Father, to be with your people and in your presence, and tonight to ponder your existence. We pray that you will overwhelm us with the evidence that you are there. Convict us strongly, and may that alter how we see life. In Jesus' name, amen. So I asked you last week to read chapters 3 and 4, and I told you I would begin by asking, what did you see? So that's my question. You read 3 and 4, what did you see? Yes, ma'am.
I thought 3 was a little confusing. Because of all the science stuff.
So I warned y'all when we started that we would get into some science. Let me emphasize, especially early, as we move beyond the question of God's existence and get more into whether God has spoken, and if so, how he has spoken, we'll deal a whole lot more with the biblical text. But yes. And I'm actually glad there are people, I am not one of them, who know the science. But let me put that on the board, because that is something we see a lot of, and we will in the next couple of chapters. Science is there. Yes, sir.
I was impressed, especially in chapter 3, where so many scientists started out to not go there and ended up there. If you know what I mean. They started out to try to prove scientifically that there wasn't a God, and then became frustrated that everything that they were learning through science indicated that there was something else out there.
Yeah, I'm gonna punt a little bit, because I'm gonna come back and say some about one of the things I think that we get when we talk to people is, if the case for faith is so overwhelming, why is it that the best and the brightest among us, such a high percentage of them, don't see it? Let me come back to that in a minute. Yes, sir.
Well, I was going the other direction. You said see, and then you came, it mentioned don't see. And it's just surprising how many bright people, as you said, the evidence is there, but refuse to see.
Yeah, so you're going to hear me say over and over again, and I'm going to repeat it. Unbelief has nothing to do with the evidence. Let me say that again. People don't reject God because the evidence is lacking. People reject God because it is a choice of their will to reject God. I shouldn't say that. That's probably not entirely fair. Well, it is. Let me add this on the end of it. There are people who have never considered the evidence. And so I want to be fair to the crowd out there. If there are people who just don't know, they've been taught to think one way their whole life and have never seen the alternative. Yes?
I think I was misled when I was younger that the Big Bang didn't happen. But I really appreciated the science behind the Big Bang being true. And I think that can be... level playing ground when coming to someone who is an atheist at being like, I'm a believer and a Christian, but I believe in the Big Bang. Like, let's chat. And finding some common ground is very interesting. And then I liked how the author laid out the science. I too thought it was very confusing, so I'm going to back you up on that. We all laughed, but it was a hard chapter to get through. And going to the law of causality was eye-opening for me. Like, all of the science backs up that something came from nothing, and that we have to have a cause for the Big Bang, and the only logical explanation is something that is very hard to explain, that is supernatural, et cetera, et cetera.
So just remember that phrases like Big Bang are not biblical phrases. And so it's kind of like talking about evolution. I think if I pulled the class and said, do you believe in evolution? Probably a strong majority would say no. When what we should say is, what do you mean, right? So the defining of terms is critical in that. And so I wondered if there might be some pushback against the book, because clearly the author of the book argues for a Big Bang caused by who?
God,
yes. And so that differentiation is really, really important. What he's talking about in the book when he talks about Big Bang is not what an atheist means when he talks about Big Bang. The causality law is also really, really critical in all that argument that everything exists has to have a cause, and so the universe has to have a cause. That factors heavily into what we'll talk about today. Good. What else? What'd you see? Yes, sir. Ma'am.
I loved the way he ended the chapter. At the very end,
Chapter three.
He quoted a book about the astronomers, and he said, "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries."
Yes. Yeah. So that actually is an interesting observation because. The way the world frames our perception of this is that everybody who is a scientist, just about, except for a few nutcases, embraces sort of this atheistic worldview, rejects God, rejects the miraculous, yada, yada, yada. But that is not entirely true, and even scientists who do not embrace the Christian's view of the world, and may even be atheist. When you get into the tall grass on this stuff, realize the fundamental problems with their view. And it could be that the Christians were right about this all along. That isn't the only guy who said something similar to that. So good point. What else did you say? Yes, sir.
Something that I knew from childhood is talking about the design of a watch. You know, it's something that obviously you have to have a designer, and of course the universe is a much more complex thing, and so it has to have had a designer.
Yes, so there are two arguments, I think, that are at work in chapters 3 and 4. Rachel already identified the law of causality, that everything that exists has to have a cause. And then, Chuck, you're alluding to the argument from design that when we see design, we assume what?
That
there had to be intelligence and power exerted to create the design. And so the argument would be if we see design in the universe, that is evidence for an intelligent designer. Yeah, that'll also play heavily into the chapter. Anyone else? Something you saw in chapters 3 and 4? Have a thought about that? Yes, ma'am.
My favorite argument has always been the second law of thermodynamics, and he mentioned that in the third chapter. That we don't get order from chaos without a designer, without the outside forces. That's just the way the world works, and there's no example of going from chaos to order without something acting on
that intelligence and power being exerted.
And that's what you would have to have if we actually evolved into all these different creatures.
Yeah. One of the curiosities I think is that when you take the time to sort of understand at least a little bit about the science, that very often science seems to line up better with the Christian's claim than the unbeliever's claim. And so, I said this at the beginning of the class, Christians should not be anti-science, but unbelievers should not blindly embrace science either, because there is good science and there is bad science, and we need to distinguish what we're talking about. Yeah, and so that law, I think, plays to our worldview better than it does to theirs. Let me take a minute to get underneath the two chapters before we dig into them and what I think is going on. We live in this world full of really amazing stuff, right? So we exist in a universe, and if you read the chapter, chapter 3, a universe where all these precise conditions have been met, pardon that Big Bang argument, to allow life to exist, but it doesn't stop there. We live on a planet perfectly and narrowly tweaked so that we are able to sit in a classroom tonight and talk about it. And when I say tweaked, what I mean by that, the slightest variation or change to the environment of Earth would render life here impossible. And then we're surrounded by all this amazing living stuff from, if you took biology and studied plants, I mean, the stupid grass growing in my yard. I could say that we have any kids in the classroom.
Well, crabgrass.
Yeah. Yes! Gaynor's crabgrass is a wonder of design. Would you dig into the details of how it's functioning? That's pretty basic stuff. That doesn't compare to what your brain is doing right now. That right now, your brain is taking in my words through your ears, and you're processing that through the world of experience your brain has recorded and preserved there. Some of you are sitting there thinking, sounds a little like a sermon he preached, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks ago. You got a few memories stored away about that, and that's intersecting this. In fact, you read chapters 3 and 4, and you thought, I know where he got that sermon a few weeks ago, because your brain stored all that away. And then you're looking at me with the eyes, you're looking at the cool picture. I just love that picture. I find a place to throw it in the whole time. So anyway, thinking people wonder about stuff like this. I mean, not every day. I had a pretty busy week. Last week, I preached every day, and so largely I was thinking about what I was going to preach that day and not the amazing world of living things around me, except for Wednesday night after church, and I was thinking about how amazing thunderstorms were, because what y'all got, we got 45 minutes later, right? Yeah, and I was dealing with that really up close and personal, like in a hotel parking lot. I was, man, that thunderstorm, we're getting acquainted, so I was thinking about it then. But thinking people think about this stuff. Now, I qualified. I didn't say all people think about this, because I don't think they do, because, candidly, I have to be unkind. Some people are not thinking. They're just getting along today or trying to survive to the weekend when they can party, and that's all their life is until they get a cancer diagnosis. And then they become thinking people, right? So, thinking people wonder about all this stuff and how it came to exist. And I think there's even stuff under that stuff. I bet y'all are getting tired of me talking about what's underneath this, because that's how my brain works all the time. What's underneath this? We think about the stuff around us because I think it's a part of our own search for meaning and purpose, like the big stuff. Why am I here? And what is it that I am supposed to be doing with my life beyond trying to get through a job Monday to Friday so I can pray on the weekend? What is this really all about? And so I think that you can take all of that and really boil it down just to two explanations. Either all of this stuff came about in some kind of natural process. Do you see what I mean when I say that? What does that mean? When I say everything came to exist through some kind of natural process, what does that mean?
It just happened.
Somehow, some way, the blind forces of nature, left to their own devices and given enough time, could do that. Could create a universe, could create this place where we live and all the stuff that's on it, left to its own nature, given enough time, could do all of this. the job of an atheist is to demonstrate for us that there is a reasonable way to explain this. I mean, you can't just say, well, I think nature did that. Okay, let's talk about that. How did nature do all that? See what I'm saying? See the problem? So the atheist has to figure out some kind of natural process. By the way, I want you to understand, and this is where we're going to kind of start clashing with atheistic science. The problem with the atheist is this is the only thing that goes on his list. He begins the search with an a priori presupposition that there is no God. Thus, there is no other cause than a natural cause. So one of the problems with atheists is they only consider natural causes. Does that make sense? What's unreasonable about that? Yeah?
The problem is it's the only time it's ever happened. If what they are saying is true, it is the only time in existence that something like that has ever happened. And proving that is going to be an impossible state. I've designed products for most of my lifetime, my adult lifetime. I've never seen one that just showed up on my desk the next morning after talking about it. Even in chapter 3, when they talked about the Kobe satellite that they sent out to go measure, somebody had to design that thing. It probably took them years and years and years to design it, only to prove that time went back and that the universe was expanding. So to take that position, you have to take the position that this is the only time that's ever happened.
Yeah, well, and it cuts off any other possibility, any other possible causes. And so when you begin with that assumption, you only consider natural causes. And if you only look for natural causes, what are you going to find? You see the problem? And so that's sometimes where science goes awry on this stuff. They find what they're looking for, even though you and I are looking at that and saying, well, God's a way more reasonable way to explain this than what they're saying. I know, but God isn't a path open to them. And so no matter how absurd their option is, it's the only one because you begin with the presupposition that natural causes are the only possibility because we eliminate God from the beginning. Yes?
So there's a good example of this in chapter 5 when it talks about intelligent versus natural, about Mount Rushmore versus the Grand Canyon.
Yes.
It's like saying Mount Rushmore, the atheist will say Mount Rushmore doesn't naturally occur. There's no other way to explain it.
Yeah. Except Mount Rushmore isn't a very impressive example, is it?
Well,
right. I mean, you guys, I've traveled a lot out west, and you know, someone will say this is Elephant Rock, and you know, if you look at it, you're thinking,
it looks like it.
Huh?
It kind of looks like it.
Yeah, it could be an elephant. I see that. Yeah. So especially when someone plants a thought in your brain, right? So I'm not disagreeing. I mean, it would be pretty hard to believe that
Grand Canyon is not very impressive either.
It'd be hard to believe that three presidents' faces or four appear, right, on the rock.
Naturally appear.
Yeah, and yet think how more impressive your brain is.
My impression has always been that they don't. They say they want natural, but they're willing to twist the laws of nature to make what they say. Because like, it just can't happen the way they say it would. It
again,
doesn't make any sense. It goes against, like, the second law of thermodynamics.
Yeah.
You can't get past that.
Yeah.
And so, but they're willing to just, but give it enough time, it will get past that.
Yeah.
You know? I'm like, what makes you think that? There's no proof of that. There's no, you can't replicate that.
Yeah, it's so that's where you end up when you are closed to other causes. Yes, last word.
Well, I was, I guess, I never heard this about Einstein on the calculations that he made for the
relativity.
Yeah, I didn't know he added a zero in there, and I've never heard that part of it, and that was surprising to me. I don't know how I missed that. But
his fudge factor?
Yeah.
That he built in? So guys, I have to tell you,
He was caught.
And we will explore this going through. It's always been a curiosity for me that if the evidence, as unbelievers claim, is so overwhelming for the atheist point of view, why has there been so much dishonesty about that? From Einstein's fudge factor to literally faked, created fossil evidence that was invented by the people who dug up the bones. I mean, there has been fraud down through time again and again. We're going to talk about some of that and why that is. Let me give you the other alternative. The other alternative is that there is a supernatural cause. Please don't hear God, because we're not to God yet. I'm just saying that the other possibility is that something outside of our world and nature and time and space as we know it caused all of this stuff to come and exist. Someone powerful and brilliant and wise caused this stuff to come into existence. We're working originally your law of causality now. Our task is to figure out which of these two is more reasonable. Can the atheist come up with natural causes that adequately explain what we see around it, or is a supernatural explanation more reasonable? Now, as we work on that, let me complain a little bit. I think when we talk to people, we give them too much in the starting of the conversation. So if we go back and we're talking about origins, we're talking about the beginning, where all of this came from, what do we usually talk about with people?
Changing from a monkey to a man, something like that.
So I think the vast majority of time when we're talking about how all this came to exist, the conversation is about the theory of evolution, or more precisely, the theory of macroevolution, and you are correct. How one kind of thing, how lizards became birds, and that's the conversation, that's the evidence that is looked at. Here's my complaint about that. I think we give too much when we're willing to start the conversation there. Why would I say that?
Started with where you got the matter for the bird to even begin from the Big Bang. Something doesn't come from nothing, and that would be
challenging. Let's start walking this backwards. I think that the naturalist has some huge leaps he's got to get past before we're even talking about the connections between lizards and birds. For example, I'm more interested in the connection between rocks and living things. Because you do realize that somewhere back there, if there is not a supernatural cause, nature has to take stuff that isn't alive and somehow make it alive, right? And if that unbeliever's theory is to be embraced, we need a natural explanation for how non-living stuff comes to be alive. And I don't think we have that conversation, which is a fascinating one. And especially more recently, with the scientific discovery in the last 100 years, and what we've learned about the complexity of life at the cellular, the molecular level. Someone's got to tell me how you get a living thing from a non-living thing. But the problem is bigger than that, because if you walk it backward from there, y'all know where unbelievers say life began, right? Sorry?
Is that amoeba or something?
And where was the amoeba?
In a pond somewhere.
In a puddle. Pond. Where is the puddle?
On Earth.
Now pause. That sounds pretty simple. We need a pond on Earth to start. Again, we give too much. The pond, Earth, is not uncomplicated. And one of the things covered in these chapters is how Earth is fine-tuned just right so you can have a pond with an amoeba in it. What question has to be answered there? How did it come about that there is this planet in this vast universe perfectly set to allow that first self-replicating cell to come alive, right? In that puddle way back when. But we're not done. Because we got to go back further than that. Before you can have her Earth, what do you have to have?
Time, space, matter.
You got to have the universe for the Earth to be in, and then, okay, where did the universe come from? What do you have to have? Well, what's their answer to that, by the way? Where did the universe come from?
They say it's been coming from, it's been there forever.
No, actually, nobody's making that argument anymore. The idea of the universe could always exist. That actually, you go back two or 300 years ago, was the argument. The universe has just always existed. But the thermodynamic laws that you alluded to and all that, you know, if that were true, energy would have run out a long, long time ago. And yeah. So everyone agrees now. Okay, universe had a beginning. And accounting for that, what is the unbeliever's explanation? We've talked about it. What? Yeah. So there was this explosion. But see, that doesn't solve the problem either, because explosions need some stuff. They need
matter.
Something has to blow up. You can't blow up nothing. It would be interesting to see somebody try to blow up nothing, right? What else do you need?
You need some kind of propulsion system.
Yeah, you need energy for an explosion. And lastly, you need a trigger. What set it all off? And so my complaint is that we begin the conversation way, way too early. Don't start talking to your friends who are unbelievers about lizards to birds. I wouldn't even talk about amoebas and ponds. I think the biggest problem for the naturalist worldview is the beginning. And before I talked about anything else, I would keep taking people back here. But let's talk about the very beginning. Yeah.
So I had this exact conversation in high school with a girl that is significantly smarter than me. That's not hard to do, but she's significantly.
See, you just took that away from me.
That's part of the strategy. All right, so she got like a 1560 on her SAT, which.
Back when that was out of score.
Yeah,
okay, I'm with you. Go ahead.
And this is a girl that grew up LDS, Mormon, and had gone atheist. And I'm like, that's a big switch. Why? Just then we had the conversation. And we took the same path backwards that you just did. And we got all the way to all of the matter in the universe is sitting on this little pinhead. It's all here. There's no empty space. And my question is, like, okay, cool. Who put that there? And I said, where did it all start? And her final explanation was, well, we know, this is 1997-ish, we know that carbon and, it's either nitrogen or oxygen, I forget whatever, I remember one was carbon, exists naturally. And that's where her faith started. And it's like, yes, this exists naturally. And it's like, well, if that's as far back as you can go in this continuum, we can't really have this conversation because carbon doesn't just exist.
Come from somewhere.
Come from somewhere. But that's where the faith, her faith started there. And it was just very interesting to see back to, I don't know if you said it or somebody said it, the folks that we think are really smart have a really hard time with this. And I almost think that they don't want it to be.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say.
Well, I think that the reason that this is valuable is there is a pretty well-known theory, because it's taught ever since kids are like in junior high school, to explain lizards to birds, right? And I think people typically have thought about that, and whether it's a good answer or not is another issue, but there is an answer. I don't think most people have thought about the very beginning. Where did everything start? By the way, what is our answer? What is our answer about the beginning?
In the beginning,
first of all, recognize that the Bible not only addresses this, but it addresses this at the beginning as the very first matter. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Question, is that a reasonable explanation? basket every way. Is it an adequate explanation?
Yes.
If the God who is presented in the Bible really does exist, then what we're told in Genesis 1:1 is reasonable. He's all powerful. He's all wise. He would be able to do what Genesis describes him doing. And so Christians have an adequate answer. It's not a natural cause, but a supernatural cause. God, outside of time and space, outside of our realm, stepped in and created. Clark, you've actually waited patiently. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, for the, you know, going back to Big Bang and scientists trying to explain where matter came from, now they're trying to put forth like quantum theories of how matter can fluctuate into existence and not and everything, and saying they can prove that, but they've only still taken it one little step further back, and they still can't explain how those laws came into effect to allow that to happen. Like, to keep moving the line further and further back, but you're still stuck with the same question, how?
Yeah. So I'm going to play the video. Do y'all remember the video from the sermon a couple weeks ago? I'm going to play a different segment, or it's a more lengthy segment of the video, because in the video you actually have the most famous atheist in the world trying to answer the question that we're talking about. So here's the thing I want you to remember about that. When you listen to this, this is one of the most famous atheists in the world who's thought about that probably as much as anyone else on the planet, and this is his current theory. And I say that because it demonstrates, just talking to your friend at work, he's not even going to know what this guy knows. And I want you to pay attention to what he says. So I'm going to ask you, when we get done, what you heard. Listen to his explanation.
Physicists are still working on the origin of the cosmos. Among them is Lawrence Krauss, whom I shall be talking to next week. Now, it is very mysterious how the universe came into being. It's a deeply mysterious and interesting question.
And can I just interrupt? It's an old question, a very old question. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century was asking the same question. He said there must have been a time when no physical things existed. But something can't come from nothing. That was his view.
Something can come from nothing, and that's what physicists are now telling us. I could give you, you asked me to give you a layman's interpretation. It would be a very, very layman's interpretation. When you have matter and antimatter and you put them together, they cancel each other out and give rise to nothing. What Lawrence Krauss is now suggesting is that if you start with nothing, the process can go into reverse and produce matter and antimatter. The theory is still being worked out.
Well, there are many troubles with Richard's teachings, but a fundamental one is that he dumbs down God and he soups up nothing.
You can dispute exactly what's meant by nothing, but whatever it is, it's very, very simple. And why is that funny?
Well, I think it's a bit funny to be trying to define nothing.
Okay, so I wrote it on the board. At the very beginning, his argument is something can come from nothing. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
So how do we account for the very beginning? Something can come from nothing. But when you listened to him, what problem did you hear?
Still trying to prove it.
Trying to prove it, yes. What else did you hear?
Well, they were still working on the theory.
Yeah.
Still working on the theory.
And he told some lies.
What, is that nothing?
Okay.
Describing something
as
nothing.
But didn't he talk about something when he was talking about, no, did you catch that?
Yes.
Matter and antimatter? What is that?
That's something.
Right? In fact, he gets confused because he talks about nothing being very, very simple. You see the problem? I like the definition I heard of nothing. Nothing is what rocks dream about. I think that was in the book, right?
Yes.
And that's it.
The rope runner.
Yeah. So, bear in mind, it is the position argued by one of the most brilliant atheistic minds on the planet. And if you push Dawkins back far enough, which is happening in this debate, and you ask, yes, but at the very beginning, this is his answer. Something can come from nothing. Now, to me, the most interesting part of that whole little segment you saw is when the audience laughs at him, not because they're mocking him. I don't think they're mocking him. I don't think they're laughing to make fun of him. Why is the audience laughing? Because what he's proposing, y'all called it absurd, but tell me why you call it absurd.
Contradiction.
With what?
With the laws science. Of nature.
It is in conflict with everything we know to be true. It is profoundly unscientific. This is the stuff of children's fairy tales, not some. Has anybody replicated the something from nothing demonstration in a lab somewhere? What university studied that? Where have we seen that reproduced so that we can look at it and marvel? I mean, this is pure fiction. And the audience laughs not to ridicule him, but because what he has proposed is against everything that we know to be true. So why would such a brilliant mind make such a silly argument?
Didn't work.
Yes.
At work, I always say to my guys when they come and ask me, like they said, Brandon, I got a question for you, and I'll tell them, well, I got an answer for you, even if I got to make something up. I say that as a joke, but that's the mentality of a person like that. They've got an answer for you, even if they got to make something up.
So that is precisely right. It is all they have. And you don't get off the hook with this. Of course, the answer that unbelieving scientists often give is, we just need more time for the science. That doesn't work here, because no matter what science demonstrates in the future, at the end, we know matter has not always existed. We know energy has not always existed. Everything had to have a beginning. At some point, you're stuck with there was nothing and something came out of it. And so, listen, here's the way I find this, why I find this is compelling. I know I got a couple of questions. I'm coming to you, I promise. Here's why I find this compelling. I think most reasonable people who are sold on believing the evidence when given the choice between, okay, something came out of nothing and in the beginning God created, find God easier to believe. That's why I don't have enough faith to believe what an atheist believes. I just can't buy this idea that something came out of nothing. Troy, I think you were first. No? Nope. Susan.
Oh, I was just going to say, even if you said something could come from nothing, there would still have to be a reason to something that would act on it, on the nothing, which he didn't. He just changed the definition.
He runs into that problem when he's explaining it, right?
Yeah, like
he keeps talking about the something and the nothing.
Acting
yeah.
upon the nothing to make it into something.
That doesn't work. Yes, sir.
Dawkins is trying to disprove supernatural things, but something to nothing would be supernatural. So he's actually disproving his own argument because he's saying something natural, which is unnatural. So that's supernatural.
I have to tell you that there are a few atheistic scientists in trying. Remember, when you reject God, and you're a thinking person and you want to account for the world around you, you have to find natural causes. Go back to Rachel's law of causality. Everything that exists had a cause. So you're stuck with the law of causality. They're looking, though, with a limited set of options. It's got to be a natural cause. And so you will find, this will not be the first time in wrestling with the theory, that the atheists border on the supernatural, just their own version of it, because nature is in the end going to be an inadequate cause. Yes, sir.
I think one of his biggest problems is that being in the world of academia, that he
believes what he says, and everybody around him is yesing him, and then he gets into an environment where people are challenging him, and he doesn't know where to go with that.
Yeah. Well, and in fairness, this is going to sound terribly unkind, but it is nonetheless true. Dawkins is a biologist. He's not a philosopher. And someone like Sam Harris would be a whole lot better than him in making some of these arguments. But frankly, William Lane Craig is a much better philosopher than George Pell, who was the Catholic representative on the debate. So you know, you're right about that. The other thing you mentioned I think is really important, and I don't want you to forget this. There is an extraordinary amount of pressure on a scientist working at a university in this country to toe the line on the atheistic worldview. And I'm not just talking about, I don't want my friends to disapprove of me. We'll tell a story later in the class about a guy out of California who followed the evidence, became a believer, and because he had tenure, they couldn't fire him, but he never taught in the classroom again. They could prevent that. And if you talk about grant money and publishing and all that kind of stuff, there's extraordinary pressure on the scientists. So please don't think that somehow these guys in the white lab coats are not subject to the same kind of stuff that we all wrestle with, peer pressure and reward for the work that you do. There, if you haven't seen the movie Expelled, Ben Stein's movie, at some time in this quarter, go back and watch it. It will demonstrate what a huge problem that is. So my recommendation, one of the things we talked about we want to do in this class is help you talk to your friends. And my recommendation is when you're talking to your friends, don't talk about lizards to birds. Don't even talk about amoebas and ponds. Talk about the beginning. I want to know, if you buy Big Bang, how did that happen? Where did this stuff come from? Because I think if you get people down to something from nothing, in the beginning, God, God's way easier. You buy that? And I want you to see that we're just getting started. If we just talk about this piece of the story, the beginning, how far are we? And how compelling is the case? And we've only started. As we progress through this, the problems just pile up for the unbelievers. It's sort of like building a circumstantial legal case. So nobody saw the guy commit the murder. Any of y'all following the murder of those four college students in Moscow, Idaho? Have y'all heard that case? So they got this guy, Brian Kohlberger, who is presumed innocent until guilty, right? So if you've been following that story, they have found some evidence. So he drives a white Hyundai. And the night of the murder, there was a white Hyundai. During the time of the murder, all around that house where the kids are, okay? Yeah, but there's a lot of white Hyundais, right? And they grabbed his cell phone data. And interestingly, this guy lived on the other side of the border in Washington. He gets in his car, and as he's driving from Washington in the direction of Moscow, his phone gets turned off. And then, after the murders, about 45 minutes later, his phone turns back on and pings a tower way south in the middle of night. And so remote, have y'all been to Idaho? I'm going to tell you, folks, you don't go far before you are remote. And he's way down there in some remote part of things. That's kind of weird, right? And then they get on his social media and they find out that he's been messaging the girls, at least a couple of them. And then they find the knife sheath, right? The knife sheath that was left at the murder scene, and what's on it? Yeah, his DNA. It's on the knife sheath. Now, nobody saw Brian Kohlberger stab those four kids. But if all that evidence is true, what do you think the jury's going to do? Yeah, they're probably going to find him guilty, because what happens is the evidence begins to have a cumulative effect. And I want you to think about that as we go through the class. All we've done is looked at the very, sort of the first piece of evidence. What about the very beginning? And found the case for belief overwhelmingly more reasonable. But guys, I don't want you to miss the cumulative weight, because we're going to add pieces and add pieces and add pieces. And as we do that, I do not want you to see the pieces individually. I want you to measure their cumulative weight. After a while, the idea that all this happened without God, it just gets beyond reason. So I want you to ponder that as we go through. Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if I can articulate this, because I've been trying to put that together. So the atheists usually tending to be evidence-based, scientific, you know, trying to explain everything to the beginning, which comes out to something that just happened by chance. So that word chance, just by chance, it just happened. So you are a scientist and you're always thinking about evidence, and then you believe in something began with just by chance. How do you explain that?
Well, and what we'll find out is it's not just by chance. It's by chance and by chance and by chance and by chance and by chance, and there are billions of, oh, it just happened to fall this way. Yeah, that is a problem. Yes, sir.
To me, there's not a difference between people that hold this view and the people that hold the same view down at the mega church down the street. It's if you jump this bridge, then you have inherent moral implications. And they're doing everything they can to not have those moral implications. Whether or not you accept a part of God or a part of the Bible versus the entirety of it, you're doing whatever logically. It still doesn't make sense to us how the most knowledgeable people down the street still can't, you know, grasp logically the whole Bible. You know, why are you on purpose leaving out written black and white portions of the Bible? It's the same. There is something inherently, there is a moral implication that they are avoiding at all costs.
Well,
it's the same problem.
Are y'all familiar with Lee Strobel?
Mm-hmm.
Read his books. The Case for Faith, The Case for Christ. One of the things that Strobel acknowledges in his own story is that when he went to college, he learned evolution. And what he loved about that is it now gave him sort of an intellectual platform from which to abandon faith so that he could misbehave. And so you're exactly right. There was a moral component to that. And by the way, it is man's struggle from the beginning. God speaks, but I don't want to do what he says. And so, to get around God, men have concocted some interesting ways of accomplishing that. And so, in our age, it is to just say, there is no evidence that he exists. I want to leave you before we're done with what was in chapter 4. He talked about anthropic constants, because it isn't just that the universe exists, but we live on this planet that is the most amazing spaceship ever constructed, because men cannot live in space. That's why we build spaceships when we send guys out there. And what you do with a spaceship is you concoct Earth's environment, brilliant minds at NASA construct a vessel that has all the things that we need to survive. The Earth is this massive spaceship, and these anthropic constants that he talks about are all these things that have to be set perfectly life right for life to exist. And so you could just make a whole list of those. He does in the chapter, the oxygen is just right, the atmosphere is just right, everything is just right to support life. The question is, how did that happen? And it's not one thing. He gives, what is it, 20 in chapter 4? I think he gives a list of 20 anthropic constants, perfectly tuned for the existence of life. You got two theories on that. Did nature do that on its own, or does that bear the marks of design? I think that it bears the marks of design, which again is an argument for the existence of God. For next week, go ahead and just read chapter 5. And we're going to go on and talk about that issue of how life came to exist. Because just getting a place where life could exist doesn't get you life. And we'll talk a little bit about what problem that is for unbelievers, too. Thank you.